Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Having flown in, here I am in the mothership, kissing the KPFA Earth. There we go. I got on a plane yesterday after the dark of moon, midterm elections, and the new moon in true Halloween Scorpio right behind us. Ah, there we go. Driving through the smoke of recently broken out fires in Northern California. Everything real, everything symbolic. So, more than perfectly, I am delighted to host a longtime ally, been on the show twice before, learned druid John Michael Greer, that we may discern the metaphysical, political, cultural strategy for now. Mirror, window, door. John Michael Greer is a widely respected author and blogger in the fields of nature, spirituality, and the future of industrial society. He is the author of more than 50 books and his blog, Ecosophia. He lives in Rhode Island. His website is ecosophia.net. Welcome, John Michael Greer.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back on.
It is. All right. So when we first cahooted way back in prehistory, I have kept with me and always attributed that you said, if you want people to get nothing done but conflict, convince them they're on one side of something and you will only get hot conflict in an already too heated world, what two needs is three, the unifying story. I keep that on. And I want to come right back to that. And then the last time I hosted you was in 2012. It's high time with your splendid book, Apocalypse Not, right? I think that's right. Liberating us from the bamboozling, fetishized con of end days and the sneaky forms of spiritual colonialism abounding in 2012. So welcome. So I treasure both of those things, and you've done much more. But it seems, wherever you want to go, of course, and I was reading about your Spengler and everything important, bring it forward. But I do love that simple thing that you bestowed upon us. If you want people to get nothing done but conflict, convince them they're on one side of something. So, yeah, we've been bamboozled into that one.
We have in a big way. And this is one of those basic, those very simple things that it's easy to think of and then it's easy to lose track of.
No.
Because so often we look and we see, oh, here's something that I'm against. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy to be against something. But unless you have someplace to go other than against, you're not going to get there.
Right. And there are words I do want to throw into Pluto's cauldron just for refreshing. And the vernacular sneakiness, you can see them rising up. So many people are using the word pushback. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just right away, you're in a polarity, and that feeds the Dementors. Now back
to
you.
And the other word that show up is resistance.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, resistance. Now, one of the many things that I've done in the course of my existence so far on this planet has been a fair amount of stuff with amateur radio.
Huh.
And one of the things you learn with electronics, resistance slows things down and creates a lot of heat.
Yes,
but
thank
that's
you.
That's all it does. So, it's very easy to get caught up in that, to look at the thing and say, oh, that's wrong, that's bad, I want to stop that. Okay, great. What do you want instead?
Right.
What do you want instead? Where else are you going? You know, here's what you don't want, here's what you have now, where are you actually going? And if it's just the opposite direction of that other thing, are you sure you're not being controlled by the other thing?
Perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Right. If I make a very topical indication right now, in something like 90 American cities, there are people out on the streets protesting the firing of Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking, you know, conservatives like Sessions. We're talking people on the left. We're talking people who are into Jeff Sessions.
Yeah.
What is going on here that we have liberals saying, no, we want to keep this unreconstructed, hardcore far-right person in the Attorney General's office? What is that saying about how far we've lost track of our dreams?
Right. Well,
we want to go.
Yes. But it's true. And then we want to liberate. And what is it they really mean? That it's the imposition of Whitaker. And the only Whitaker I know before is Whitaker Chambers. And we go, right, so it's all speaking to us. But yes, excellent point that it is a fear-based reaction, which is understandable, and what I've been brewing for a long time, and so delighted to hand it back to you is The Dementors of Doom. So my audience knows that I always reference, you know, Gary Lachman's book, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Era of Trump.
Yeah, which I've read, yes.
Which
I have read, yes.
Yeah, and it's useful, I think, because the Bannons, you know, are skilled in story, metaphor, bamboozling craft. And a lot of the progressive left, until now, you know, kind of left story and metaphor and the power of magic and cooperating with things going, at great cost, right?
At great cost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but they do horrible things that make us angry and outraged, but that feeds them. Right.
Uh-huh.
So exactly what you said, you know, anger, outrage, but cooked immediately in Pluto's cauldron into desire. Are you in accord with that's in accord with yourself?
Yeah. Well, my question is, where do you see the desire going? When you cook it in the cauldron, what are you doing with the desire?
For beauty and fairness and
okay.
more specific things.
Okay, good. But it has to be more specific. The problem is so often it's just I want that. It's actually what they don't want, and you get this complete tangle where people are so caught up being against that they forget to be for.
Yeah,
and Trump in particular is a genius at this. Watch the way every time for the last 2 years, he's launched a Twitter storm. Or he's done something or said something. Watch what else is going on at the same time. He's doing it as camouflage.
Yeah, yeah.
He basically jumps on this thing and sends out this tweet that either makes no sense, maybe it's talking about COVID-19 or something like that, or it's making some outrageous claim. Everyone starts yelling about that. And then this other thing that's going on elsewhere, nobody's paying attention to it. That's where the action is.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's basically, you have to act rather than react. And a lot of people are allowing themselves to be caught up purely in a reactive state.
Right.
Where, you know, and that's easy to get into. That's easy to get into when things that are important to you are, you feel they're threatened, they're in danger, but you can be manipulated by that fear. And this is, you know, this is a huge factor these days.
Right, which is why in many forms I like us spiraling forth telepathic, homeopathic doses of psilocybe mushrooms to the entire populace, because it calms down the amygdala, right? I mean, Johns Hopkins and tradition says that, which is the reactive scanning, the most easily manipulated fear, reactive pushback thing. It calms that down and increases confidence and kindness and cooperation among the other regions of the brain. We go, right, there we go. Right, so exactly as you say, so that we can be agents of cool response in a hot, reactive world. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's at that point we can start pursuing what we desire rather than just running from what we fear.
Definitely. And the reason I love you also as a cultural hijink strategist is, you know, that sane reverence in specific forms assume cultural narrative lead, so it's not just reactive. And even just all the sneaky cons that create, you know, Jim Acosta being banned from the press room or whatever, and we go, yes, but liberating trickster can never have its press credentials pulled. So anyway, the mythic news, the druidic John Michael Greer news, the Coyote Network news, and so the spiraling thing, and it's true, it is, you know, we're not out of the woods, we're just heading into the woods. You know, Saturn's image right now is 10 logs lie in front of an archway leading to darker woods. And we go, the need to feel ritually prepared. And we go, ooh. So, but heading into compost conniption fits so that we are free agents. But there is, America, or largely white America, is having a psychotic episode. You know, more mass shooting yesterday, you know, and everything. And even on a microfractal level, you know, like we, you know, to have hate turn, a friend of mine went out with friends of her husband's who went, you know, completely nuts in the middle of the dinner because they had a Beto O'Rourke sign, and this was Texas. And guy kept referencing, I've got guns and I don't like you. I mean, really, this was like passes for a proper white dinner. And we go, well, did you ever see Brain Dead?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, I mean, I know you are pure and read scholarly books, and that's really important for us.
I just don't get into visual media. It's one of the things.
That's okay. I'll do it for you, and I touch you for luck as well. But Braindead was it was a 2016 8 episode only, but it was such a useful metaphor. It was like a very hip political version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, in which insects from outer space take over people's brains. Politicians first, but the symptom was thriving on conflict, incapacity for compromise, and also get very organized, right? Because the right wing crazy people, I mean, they are organized. And it was an equal opportunity offender. It was very charming because it says, and then they take great pride in their body and they go to yoga and they only drink green drinks. And it's like, okay, go get them, you know, attack the liberal vegans too. But anyway, but it was useful and it really did go somewhere and it was a useful metaphor and there was an antidote. Chocolate, sex, and love could drive the insects out, and we go, there we go. So, but it was surprisingly astute and really on it, and went away. But anyway, but yeah, I want to toss back to you. I find a useful metaphor without getting freaked out is possession. Meaning there's group mind, right? Mm-hmm. And the Dementors have been very good at filling group mind, you know, with the worst reactive hate-mongering, us against them here. Mm-hmm. Okay. But so it behooves us, really, to spiral into collective mind, expanded repertoire of responses so that those of us not in a hot reactive moment where our dinner partners are threatening us with guns, you know, can make available, or we're not in Yemen, or not, you know, whatever, we're not in a hot reactive place, so it behooves us as a kind of evolutionary spiritual responsibility to waft that out. Does that resonate with yourself?
Yeah. Basically, one of the ways that I tend to think of it, and of course, this is one of those situations where no one metaphor does the job.
Right.
But it's precisely because so many of us have lost our center in this. So many of us are not really in tune with who we are, what we want, and are too busy worrying, too busy being outside of ourselves. And I think one of the things, and this is very difficult in a time that's stressful, but it's as crucial as it's difficult, is to stop and take a deep breath and to do whatever else you need, whether it's the chocolate or, you know, and what have you. But to get back to ourselves and to do some stock taking and to look, you know, just shake ourselves and go, okay, what are we reacting to? Why are we reacting so automatically to this? And it's very easy to get caught up again in that hot reactive space. That's one of the things that makes it very useful for demagogues of both sides.
Yeah.
But to step back from it, at this point, I honestly think that in some ways that's a supreme political act, to actually step out of the heat, to stop and think. And you know, you can go right back and get heavily involved if you want to in the whole political thing. But take a break every so often to catch your breath, bring yourself back to your center, refocus, and say, okay, what am I actually doing here? What am I working toward? What is the goal that I'm after?
Right. And why have I complicitously, as we entertain that possibility, directed the movie this way so that this is in front of me now? And how do I respond?
Yeah. What is our personal involvement in this, and what are we getting out of it? One of the things, of course, this is one of those very edgy bits of psychology, and I think Alfred Adler, who was one of those, he and Jung and Freud, of course, were way back there messing with people's heads. But Adler always liked to point out that if you have one of these situations that keeps on recurring and keeps on recurring, and everyone's, you know, oh, whoa, okay, if it keeps on recurring, what are you getting out of it?
Or. Yes, and then also what I like to do with self and others is going, has anything like this ever happened to you before?
Does it have
a resonance? Therefore, it's relevant. And then to accept complicity, not shame, not blame, but creative contributing.
Exactly.
And then we can inhale back. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a million ways to go from here. But it comes back to a conversation I had with a deep conservative. Everything we've ever done kind of rises now to be deepened. And our introductory conversation. A friend of mine said, that's the most conservative person in the room, go talk to him. And we became great friends. And because he started off by saying, you know, what do you know about, oh, I'm going to forget the name, what do you know about Edmund Burke? And I go, oh, not much. And he said, well, this conversation about big government, small government's irrelevant. What Edmund Burke said is the more we cultivate inner, I'll say Saturn, inner citizenship qualities, the fewer outer rules we need. And I go, this is an excellent conversation. Right? For each one of us to go inner democracy and do progressive groups, do we treat each other with respect?
And thank you.
And democracy, or are we like, you know, and remember Alison Lurie's wonderful quote, the reason academic politics is so vicious is because the stakes are so small. It's really useful, left-wing infighting. Let's put left-wing infighting into the cauldron, because that's heat, and that's complicitous with tyranny, really.
Yeah, I mean, you look painfully often, when you look at the various groups that are fighting Trump, you will find a lot of little Trumps in those groups who are mirroring him, who are mirroring his spirit, who are mirroring his ego. And the one very useful and sometimes very painful thing to reflect on is the old occult maxim, what you contemplate, you imitate.
Right. No, this is a tough one. Right.
It's a tough one.
Yeah.
If you're spending all your time staring at Donald Trump, you're becoming Donald Trump.
Or the demon that inhabits him. I like that metaphor myself.
Okay, if that works for you.
Right, without getting freaked out or abdicating responsibility.
I see him. I mean, Nietzsche's comment, human, all too human.
Yeah, that's good too.
Either way, you know, what you contemplate, you imitate. Whatever you're staring at all the time, you're gonna tend to take that into yourself. So what are you looking at? What are you looking at? Or if you're spending, you know, there's got to be something more interesting to look at than Donald Trump.
Well, I think what we do want, you know, as again, cultural contributors in, with with flora, fauna, all the critters to be included in this dynamic is, you know, all right, so we know what we don't. What are qualities of wise governance? How do we no longer abdicate our responsibility for dreaming government into being? It's us. It's us.
You know, it's us.
Yeah, and you have that great, you know, Spengler quote of elitist plutocracy disguised as democracy. And we go, that's good too, right? Prison disguised as freedom abounds in music and, you know, it's a good category going, am I liberated or imprisoned by this?
Exactly.
Is this the real thing or the toxic mimic? Yeah.
Is this, you know, am I going through the motions of something that actually benefits someone or something else?
Like what? Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, again, democracy. We have this idea of what democracy is. And I'm going to take this, your comment, you know, have I seen this before? Have I done this before? Have we been through this before?
Right.
One of the things that Spengler does, and it's one of the things that makes a lot of people hate his guts, is that he looks and says, okay, what happened the last time? What happened when Rome went through this? What happened when Athens went through this? Other societies that had an elected government. Okay. We like to use the term democracy as a catch-all for every, you know, a government that will do everything we want for us. But democracy, you know, Winston Churchill's comment comes to mind. It's the worst system of government there is, except for all the others.
Right. We might look to the Iroquois from whom it was borrowed but they edited out the thing that made it work, which was the Council of Grandmothers who had the veto.
But the thing is, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how, but we never got to see how the Haudenosaunee Confederacy worked over the long term.
Right.
Because, you know, very often a government will work very well for the first generations. What happens after that? And that's what, or it doesn't work very well for a long time, and then it gradually improves. You look at the situation, the historical trajectory of England, for example, where Parliament started out as a place for the very rich to get together and decide what they were going to do with the rest of society. And while Britain is by no means perfect at this point, it's not quite that anymore. So there are trajectories that move through political history, and we can look at where we are and where we're going and understand by comparison, okay, does this rhyme? Does this seem familiar? What lessons can we draw from this? And one of the lessons that Spengler draws is precisely that democracy, the great weakness of democracy is that, you know, one way or another, most people's votes are for sale. And sooner or later, the very rich figure out how to make use of that. So when we have a situation where both political parties are receiving umpty godzillion dollar donations from the very well-to-do, and both political parties are in one way or another pandering to the interests of different conglomerations of wealth and influence, and you start figuring out why people are turning away from that toward some system which, while it may be unjust, actually has a better chance of getting their of them actually getting some of their needs met.
You mean authoritarianism in Brazil and stuff? I mean, or
exactly, because if a representative democracy, if all the representatives are basically, you know, the representative from big corporations, then authoritarians can appeal to them and say, well, you know, I'm not for sale. I may be a goose-stepping jerk,
right?
But I'm actually going to provide you with this, this, and this, and this. And this is the thing we forget at our peril when people use the word fascist, okay? And they use it pretty generally to mean, I hate you. Okay. And people, I think people have almost entirely forgotten how wildly popular fascism was, because it came in the various European nations, the various Latin American nations, the other places where it picked up. It came into a situation where democracy had frozen up around wealth, and you had the best politicians money could buy. And so people turned to Mussolini, they turned to Hitler, they turned to a galaxy of other people that most people don't even remember anymore, who were saying, there's another, you know, let's get rid of this charade and follow me and we will fix some things.
Right.
Well, okay. That's where democracy falls into trouble. And until each of us looks in ourselves, as you were saying, how do we ourselves live more democratically? How can we make the system work in a way that actually reaches out to the people who've been excluded from the debate?
Yes, and also when you say, you know, okay, 1930s Germany, you know, the last time that Jornes was in Taurus, so in Europe we got fascism, in America you got the New Deal, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, as Twain allegedly says, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, right?
But it rhymes.
So we have a resonance, but here, and this is where I think I can, you know, we are cohooting in the realm of democratic animism, which is, you mm-hmm. know, we got to, you know, maybe even derive our leadership models and our democracy models, forget humans, from nature. I'm very mm-hmm. fond of the wolf leadership model, because when we think of, you know, no species on this earth would outsource leadership to a being that did not care about the well-being of the pack. I mean, mm-hmm. no other, not even, you know, aggressive baboons or no, they would not do that. So again, kind of looking at that, so mm-hmm. there's a lot of ways to go, but
there's a lot of ways to go, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, are you as a druid animist possibly? Mm-hmm.
This makes perfect sense, and it's a crucial metaphor, and because you can look through the various sectors of our society and say which of these sectors have not been receiving any benefit, which of these sectors, let's use the baboon model, okay, who's being driven to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Who's being brought to the center? And if you see groups being permanently pushed to the outside, permanently assigned the status of you don't matter, and by one or both sides, you know, you can see immediately, there's your constituency for the guys with the armbands.
Or, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it can go a lot of ways. That's the kind of Piscean
exactly.
realm of what's been dissed and exiled. And absolutely what you're saying, and heard a little snippet of somebody's talk on the origins of terrorism are corruption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you go, you know, to somebody and go, the judge won't hear my sister's case unless she sleeps with him, and the person says, we will fix all that.
Exactly.
Right. So,
and that was exactly how Mussolini did things too. The regime that invented the term fascism. Okay, Mussolini was hugely popular because he went in and said, you know, we have all of these social problems that are not being dealt with. We have all of these situations where the politicians are just bickering among themselves, and dividing up the loot. You can't get anything done. So he did the march on Rome. The fascisti took power, and he actually delivered All you had to do was sign away certain rights that nobody was using anyway, because they couldn't actually exercise them. You know, you have the right to go to the voting booth once every years and vote for a pre-chewed collection of candidates, and you give up that and all of it, you know. But you can go to your the local chair, you know, the local office of the fascist party, and you can present your complaints, and very often something would be done about them. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people on the left forget these days. The fascists got power because they actually fixed things.
Right. Well, we can sort of leave that out of the current equation with the Trumpel-Stiltskins, but because they can't. Well, but they are thriving.
But the thing to keep in mind, have you looked at the job statistics?
Yeah.
The thing more than anything else. That's when I was talking about people being pushed to the outside. People in the working class who, due to various policies that were pursued bipartisanly by both parties until the Trumpist revolution, okay, they could go whistle for a change in those policies. Well, the policies have been changed, and all of a sudden people in the working classes have jobs again. That's going to be a very difficult argument. That's one of the reasons I think we saw, the blue wave turn into a purple ripple.
Or rainbow. Rainbow, as Van Jones said.
Rainbow is good too.
Women, Native Americans, lesbians.
And in particular, the thing that I found actually very promising about the election was that it was especially the people in the middle, the people who were pursuing the kind of the W. Obama consensus, what had been standard bipartisan policy up until recently, they were the ones who got clobbered. Well, we had the Democratic Socialists doing extremely well. We had populists doing very well. We had anybody who wanted to shake up the system doing tolerably well. And a lot of people who were trying to do the business as usual thing either simply stepped down a la Paul Ryan or lost their seats.
Right.
So people are ready for change, and we're in a bit of a race here to see who is actually going to offer them real opportunities for change.
Right. Well, that's where we are exhorting everybody, right? I mean, in a sense, the rising sign for our chart today is a woman within all of us with a bugle calling in a new tide of cultural energy.
But with a specific story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me call up the chart here. I got it right here.
Okay, there we are. Yeah. So Seven Pisces Rising, this is, from Berkeley and all. But it is powerful. So the push to the outside. Oh wait, let's see. There's a million things. We're going to have a very short break in 3 minutes. But we have plenty of time. I will breathe. But this is really fun. I'm so glad you're here. You're the perfect dance partner for right now, John Michael Greer, EchoSophia.net. But I also push to the outside. But I also love this National Geographic film clip in which there was an outside Lois cast chimpanzee just ate last everything until he found a barrel, and he began hitting it with a stick and going up and downhill, a drum. And the other monkeys looked at that and were like, wow, cool. And they made him the leader, right? Anyway, so Venus was reemerging on election day, going, beauty and art and kinship as leadership qualities and trickster. And it is anomalous, right? It's not for everybody, but we're going for anomalous. I mean, going for that.
Anomalous is the only option we've got at this
point. I love that. That's a bumper sticker. Wait, anomalous is the only way to go? Is that the only option?
The only option we've got. Anomalous is the only option we've got now.
Right.
Yeah.
It goes well with a situation so dire we can't afford the luxury of realism.
It's
these are good shopping bags. These are good bumper stickers. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, because we do want to put things out into the memosphere that have a liberating resonance, right?
Very much so, yes. Because it's got to be about not being stuck. It's got to be about not being bogged into or locked into some kind of this sort of radical dualist framework.
Right.
We need to go from 2 to 3. We need to go from 3 to infinity. There are many. This is a world in which many worlds coexist. Let's embrace that.
Yeah. And the spiral. The spiral is...
And the spiral.
Again, the cultivating the skill of our citizen trickster, our bodhisattva coyote, who liberates, out of the polarity into spiral and all right. All right, we're going to take a very short break here. This is very exciting. Our perfect for today guest, John Michael Greer, because it is perfect, right? Because we got rescheduled a couple of times. We got booted by the Kavanaugh hearings, but here we are. You're the perfect. You're the perfect guest for after this thing. His website is echosophia.net. Tweet your friends, have them join us for this second half, because this is really pertinent, spicy, speaking to your inner wise self. There we go. And we'll be right back after this very short Taj Mahal break.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Off get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, here at the home mothership KPFA in Berkeley for a brief jaunt. Our more than perfect for now guest is John Michael Greer, widely respected author, blogger in the fields of nature, spirituality, and the future of industrial society. His website is echosophia.net. And we are here. Yes, I'm brewing my citizen trickster courses in many forms too. Going, what is it? So back to the 800,000 pertinent things you were bringing up, John Michael Greer. So when things are pushed to the outside, see, this is a crucial strategy moment for all of us, because a number of things can happen. One is, and this is really the Pisces-Neptune realm, which is the realm of all that's been exiled, imprisoned, dissed, undervalued, but said to be where a culture's soul or its replenishing vision lives. So it depends on how a culture relates to its outsiders. And I love, Carolyn Raffensperger often references this historic moment of the Pueblo uprising of the mid-17th century, catalyzed by an outsider living in their midst, could speak all the languages, including the colonizer language of Spanish, could predict the weather. So he talks to everybody because he's the only one who can. Sometimes the outsider is the only one who can talk to everybody. And he says, the weather will be such and such. It'll be difficult for the Spanish to resupply. If you want to boot them out, now's the time. And they rose up. But even cooler, we're back to Jupiter. 12 years later, one story cycle later, they invited the Spanish back, not as conquerors, but as collaborators in irrigation projects and so on. And so the outsider, part of all of us, when culture's in big trouble, sometimes it turns to its outsider. And we do see this with, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Beto O'Rourke. What a pure being. Oh, my God. I don't know. I can hear you inhaling, possibly in disagreement.
Not especially. Since I don't live in Texas, I there were a lot of races for me to follow.
Well, let me just say that the reason I embrace him is that he was consistently spicy in his critique and all embracing in his invitation, and he never got snookered into polarity. Never.
Okay.
That's what I mean by he had the mirror. Here's how it is. He had the window. This is how it could be. Come on. And he had the door. So regardless, he won. It was Texas. And after all, it's like, so he was an extraordinary example, embodiment of what we're talking about. Truly gifted and a kind of miracle in Texas.
Okay.
And then there was all this chicanery in Georgia, which, I think it's going on because we are heading into this election may not be over for quite some time. There are appropriate lawsuits and stuff because there was tremendous chicanery in Georgia and probably Florida and North Dakota.
The thing is, one of the things to keep in mind with American politics is there's always chicanery going on. There's always a lot of it, and if I may be frank, on both sides. It's part of the political landscape. The importance, yes, you challenge it when it shows up, and you're aware that it's not, again, it's not a dualistic thing. It's part of the landscape. And so we deal with that, we incorporate it, and we say, pick up, move on. What's the next goal?
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways in which Trump's side has been, frankly, brilliant in their management of their opponents. And it's one of, I don't know if it's Trump himself or it's somebody who works for him or something, but somebody there has figured out you can get people mired in the past, so in what happened, so that they don't pay attention to what's happening. I mean, how long did it take people to stop yelling about the 2016 election? Have they stopped yet?
Well, I think so.
Okay, it happened. One may reasonably be upset with the outcome.
Oh, I
but
see.
The important thing is, what do you do now?
Right. So you're also saying, let us snip the obsessive, distracting web of even concern over the Russians and stuff.
Except,
it's ongoing, maybe.
Except if it is ongoing.
If it is, yeah.
One of the traps here, again, then here we see, I'm gonna invoke a slightly different specter, which is that of Carl Jung. The projection of the shadow, the looking for the thing outside that is the cause of everything that goes wrong.
Yep.
It's a very easy habit to fall into. And to the extent that the Russians had some kind of involvement, I mean, frankly, I would be amazed if every major country in the world doesn't put some money into influencing U.S. elections. I'm sure the Saudis do, for example. The Germans would be idiots not to, and they're not idiots. Japan, everybody tries to influence U.S. elections, just as we try to influence elections everywhere around the world.
Yep.
We meaning the U.S. government, and probably some of the subsets thereof. But is that what happened in 2016? I would argue not. Is that what happened in 2018? Very clearly not. There's more going on here, and unless we learn the lessons of the past and then apply them to the future, we keep on getting snookered in the same way.
Right, and so in a way, I mean, where we're in accord is let us no longer abdicate our responsibility for dreaming the world into being, and go, all right, so let's inhale. Okay, here comes inner democracy. We have outsourced, leadership to incompetent sociopathic dingbats who care nothing for life. Let us inhale that back in and begin that conversation, which is happening. And again, I think that is part of the, Alexander. Andrea Ocasio-Cortez and Beto O'Rourke, and it's a smart conversation.
I think there's some very good things going on there. While we're inhaling, though, I think we want to also inhale, so to speak.
Yes.
While we're inhaling,
yes.
There's a lot of trying to outsource our salvation, our political salvation, to someone else.
Yeah.
You saw a lot of that with Hillary Clinton back during the 2016 election. The very embarrassing Hillary Clinton is light itself editorial that came out afterwards and so on.
I never saw that, thank goodness. But
But we need to remember that it's not someone else who's going to solve this problem.
No.
We can't simply put all of our hopes on some politician. Okay, it's what the statue of Apollo said to Rainer Maria Rilke. Du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life.
I woke up with that phrase in my mind.
Excellent.
That's Rilke's poem about Rodin's statue.
That's the one.
Say it again.
Yeah, du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life. You must make your life other.
Because I think the setup to that is you're looking at the massive strength and the authentic embodiment of the thing, and that inspires us going, ooh, I want to be more etched.
I want to abdicate my own responsibility to this lump of stone. I want to learn from the statue. I want to learn from the statue what to be, or how I might be, or some of the possibilities that are open for me to be. And in that way, we start internalizing our own capacity to lead ourselves, which is what democracy at its best is about. It's about people leading themselves and joining together to lead themselves collectively to a better place.
Yes, that's great. And again, part of the skill set. Okay, so we hoover things in, and that's also when people get whatever it is, chemtrails or whatever, and they go, yeah, but what's their solution, or is it a distraction? Does it inhale back our intention, our focus, and our forgiveness of self? It's like I had noble things I was going to do, on election night, but instead I binged on, leftover Halloween candy going, no, don't do that. No, read Rilke's poem. Just no. that.
But the thing is, there are times when eating leftover Halloween candy is the most sensible thing you can do.
Sometimes, that's right. But it is all about, we are responsible anyway. But back to our trickster selves, right? So Carl Jung, projecting the shadow, right?
Projecting the shadow. And, you know, even if the Russians were investing some money, which, as I say, if they weren't, they were idiots, and they're not. Everybody is. It would be a hoot to have the necessary resource to do some serious investigation, come up with a link or with a list of how many other countries spent how much money trying to influence the 2016 election. I'm sure the list is longer than your arm and my arm and three or four other arms put together, including at least one orangutan. So the thing is, yes, that happens, but we need to look at ourselves. We need not to use that as a distraction, not to look at how was this election handled? How did we handle it personally? How did each of us, you know, in our political involvements, how did the two parties, or I should say the four parties that were running candidates, how did all that work? Because one of the problems that we saw in this election cycle was a real attempt to refight the 2016 election on the part of a lot of Democrats. And
like who?
I'm thinking strategy here. Not so much they weren't talking about the election. But if the election is all about, you know, we really, really, really hate Trump, the election's about Trump.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Okay.
Well, many people didn't mention him at all. I mean,
how many of them were offering something other than the same thing that the Democrats have been offering since Bill Clinton?
Well, this is where there's, you know, 10, 20, 30 stories all going on at once,
yeah.
And they can be conflicting and all be true.
Which
one are we going to vote for? As the moon and Jupiter are conjoining overhead and we will see them setting in the west, possibly blood red in California due to the fires. Whoa!
Mm-hmm.
But power of storytelling again. But again, the idea of creative disruption of the narrative, uh-huh. There's no prison for the unexpected.
Exactly.
You know, so like with my friend who was attacked by, dinner by right-wing person, whatever. And I go, you know, a wonderful thing that I've used on one occasion when hate turned towards me at a dinner, otherwise, you know, disguised as civilization, is Groucho Marx. I've had a wonderful evening. This wasn't it, but I've had a wonderful evening. Because you leave self-responsible jaunty. Right.
Yeah.
And other people are slightly confused, but you've disrupted the polarity with jaunt. I'm very in favor of jauntiness, you know, as one of our responses.
Exactly. There needs to be a whole toolkit, if you will,
yes.
Of possible responses. But yeah, that kind of the being unwilling to be drawn into
yes.
The binary relation, and then you can posit something else. You can posit humor. You can posit a way of looking at the thing that. This is to go back to a metaphor that I like to use. When you're dealing with a magical struggle, and that's what we're dealing with
yeah,
here,
right.
You're dealing with a struggle between competing storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
The question is, which one can tell a story that is more compelling, that is more appealing, that draws you into it? Because you can draw the other storyteller into your story, and then all of a sudden, there's a common story going on, and we can move forward. One of the things that Donald Trump has been able to do is to tell a story that appeals to a lot of Americans, and it particularly appeals to a lot of the Americans who have felt themselves excluded from the political process. And he presents that. He presents that, you know, as you've been excluded. You've been, you know, make America great again. Here's the situation that was. Here's what we can do. He's good at that. He doesn't have to be a good person to be a competent storyteller, but to his audience, he's very effective. Now, we need to look at that, say, what story is he telling? Why is it appealing? What story can we tell that incorporates that and builds on it and sweeps it off into someplace more positive?
I invite you to watch just even some of the snippets of Beto O'Rourke, because he did that every time. Compete used to mean to strive together. So there's that.
Yeah, exactly.
So
and it can be worked that way. In fact, that's much more effective again than trying to do the binary thing.
Right. Well, story blessing poker. I hear you. Uh-huh. And see, I think that's part of our repertoire that we fill our magic backpacks with, because I keep thinking of, you know, moments when I was sort of attempted in polarity and my friend who was attacked at dinner and everything like that. But surprise liberates everybody from that story. And one of the ways is to go, okay, hate-crazed white psychotic person in an episode. What's your definition of good government?
Mm-hmm.
What's a good leader to you? I mean, I've had enough spiraling things in which people go, oh, or, you know, build the wall. I go, okay, you now have $1 billion. What's the first thing you do with that?
Yeah.
You know, but by asking it without snark, right? See, because it can't be snarky. No, it's got to be Jupiter, which is, you know, did you know, genuine curiosity.
Exactly. And one of the third rail subjects comes in here because we have one of the things that has not had a lot of space in our collective conversation is the role of social class.
Yeah.
There are a lot of the Trump voters see themselves as being put down, being looked down upon, being sneered at by those, not the elite, but those one notch above them, by the middle classes, by the intelligentsia, the educated people. That rankles. And so when you change that conversation and you're actually saying, okay, you know, what is your definition of good government? What would you do with, and you're actually, and listen to them.
Right.
You're completely redefining the terms of relationship in a way that pops them out of that overfamiliar narrative of being held one down by the snot-nosed know-it-all.
Right, and I would say to all of ourselves, everyone in the magical realm, that we are willing to throw into the cauldron any sneaky complicity we have to being snot-nosed, condescending, because condescending means we all go down together, and there's a lot of that in the thing.
Together.
Going, oh, you know, you're hopeful, but if you knew what I knew, then whatever, and you don't know. And it's like, flag on that play, condescending attitude, you know, embodying colonialism, no matter what label you stick on your butt. Okay, there we go, ball back in play. But the sneering, the snark, and when you know, because those are all fuels we run on, and I like to say, you know, running on snark is the equivalent of running on tar sands. It's a very gummy... It's a very gummy fuel, right?
And I like that.
Yeah, feel free. You are such a gift of metaphor. We can to and fro. But yeah, no, I think that's really important. And then there's one thing that I want to tease forth because I love this quote so much that rose from a pile of papers and I've been using it ever since. Forgive me, listeners who've heard it, but I love it and I want to explore it. It was Augustus Hare who said, "Half of the failures in this world come from reining in one's horse as he's leaping."
Right. Yeah.
I love it because he doesn't say all the failures. He goes half. You know, but see, here's Jupiter in Sagittarius. It's our horse. Mm-hmm. And you know, and in a say, there were, you know, all the things you're delineating about, you know, creepy stuff in the election and also these good things as well. You know, and these are our horses. And we might be able to feel when in the past, you know, individually and collectively, did we rein in our horse when he was sleeping? You know, going, no, not ready, no, not done. And it's like, all right, everybody, on your horses. Let's become one with the horse, the wise horse in the fairy tales. Let's go. Let's go. So I like, because it's such a physical metaphor. It's like you really like that thing. And uniting with our wise pony in the fairy tale kind of thing.
And that's very good advice just now. And the whole, I mean, Jupiter in Sagittarius is also a great metaphor for what we need to do going forward from here. Jupiter is in his strength, and Sagittarius is going places.
Yeah.
Now's the time where it's necessary to break free of this kind of this very stuck quality that so many people have been in, to look at, okay, what do we actually want? What is our idea of good governance? What do we want government to do? And how are we going to make that reach out to everybody? That's that Jovian expansiveness that brings everybody in. Okay, what about, you know, the white working class guys who have been, you know, who have been scraping by on three less than part-time jobs, and now they have a good job again? What are you going to say to them? Because you're going to have to say to them something to them, or they're not. They're just going to keep on, you know, voting for what's the phrase? The Geotus.
What is the Geotus?
God Emperor of the United States.
Oh, Geotus,
as opposed to POTUS, yeah.
Well, I also like Scrotus, which is so-called ruler of the United States, but that's, it works well. But Geotus is good because it's true. I don't want to use his name. But
no,
Scrotus.
But Geotus, the thing is, Geotus is what his followers call him.
Really?
Go on to Reddit sometime if you're ready for that, and look up r/thedonald.
r/TheDonald?
It's the_Donald, okay? That is the Reddit fan community for fans of Donald Trump.
And what is Geodis again?
The Geodis, God Emperor of the United States.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah. Now, partly, it's a metaphor out of a video game, okay?
Right. Well, everything is, right? No, right.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I really want to encourage, on the off chance that there's anybody listening to us who is a Donald Trump supporter, okay, go to some of the places where people in the resistance are talking, okay, and then those of you who are not Donald Trump supporters, go to Donald Trump to places like r/TheDonald and just listen. In both cases, just listen, lurk, pay attention, notice what's going on, try to get a sense of what the other folks are thinking, because they are thinking.
Right.
Try to find out what are their feelings, because it's very easy to get into that snark space. It's very easy to get whether it's the snark space on the one hand, or the all-out Gnostic binary, you know, you are the children of evil, and we, of course, by that definition, are the defenders of light and truth and purity. Not so. There's more going on here,
right.
And you cannot deal with a situation like that until you actually understand what the other side is feeling, where they're coming from, why what they're doing makes sense to them, and no, it's not just because they're the evilest evil that ever eviled with a double helping of evil sauce on the side.
Right, although you're bringing up, these are important things. See, I've never really used the word evil until...
I'm glad.
Until now, just in the sense of, and I want to toss it to your learned self.
Uh-huh.
One is, first, little sidebar, invoking Carl Jung. Right, because we do watch ourselves, and it's like, now, Caroline, don't get grumpy about somebody being grumpy. Don't get snarky about somebody being snarky. It's very sneaky.
It's
right.
very sneaky.
It's very sneaky.
The shadow is always there.
Yeah.
And it always reflects you back to yourself. It always reflects me back to myself. And so one of the useful things of the political crisis of our time is precisely that it's made it very, very difficult, although people are doing a heroic job of it, makes it very, very difficult to ignore the presence of the presence of those shadow projections.
Well, okay, so the journey about evil, I mean, I like Neil Douglas Klotz, Aramaic scholar, saying what gets translated to us as evil from the Aramaic that Jesus would have spoken vernacular,
mm-hmm.
in Aramaic means unripe.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that, because what do you do with unripe things? You put them in a brown paper bag, which is easy to imagine descending over Congress. So I like that thing.
I like that.
They're in a journey. They're unripe it now. Okay, so I like that. However, you know, and then these are, we could talk forever. Then, you know, talking with people who are very ayahuasca from Colombia, you know, and, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of polarity that comes along with the ayahuasca thing. Evil spirits are out to get you and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was talking with this guy who's done 300 ayahuasca trips and thinks it's good for everybody, and it's an interesting conversation. And then he was saying, you know, I was saying, you know, I don't use the word evil often, but the separating of children from their parents, he goes, that's evil. And I go, I think it is. I think it is. I want to toss it to you to what to do with. And then he said, I've seen evil. And I go, I think I saw evil once. And I said, when you saw evil, was it in an ayahuasca vision? He goes, absolutely. That's what ayahuasca shows you. And I'm like, no, it's a whole other interesting conversation. Now back to you.
Okay. If it's evil to separate children from their parents,
yeah.
Has it been evil to do that in the African American community where that's been a routine?
Absolutely.
Practice?
No, and Native American and everything, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
And everything. So the thing that I see here, and the thing, and this is the thing that in some way Trump is very useful for, is that he's forcing us to see, you know, the things that we've been doing all along.
Yes. No, absolutely.
And
complicity.
The things that we have been doing all along, where were the complaints when, I mean, the standard practice these days, when an African-American person goes to jail, a single mother, let's say, she loses her kids.
Yeah.
Automatically, CPS takes them away, and her chances of getting them back, even if she's going for just a brief prison stay, are minimal. Who's protesting that?
Well,
the problem here, and the thing that has really turned up the heat, I think, on our collective psyche, is the picking and choosing that you have.
Mm-hmm,
if Donald Trump does it, it's uniquely evil. But what about everyone else?
Right.
I want us to catalyze, to use that experience to catalyze our awareness of the everyday evil that we've all been complicit in. And again, to look for the Donald Trump in all of us. Because he's there. He wouldn't occupy such an immense position in our collective psyche right now if he wasn't already present in every single one of us.
That's good. I think that's good. Our inner, it was Ho'oponopono, right? I mean, heal the world by healing within. And then also, you know, cultivating our inner democracy, which is part of the astrological language. Again, and everything wants to be cleansed of its superstitious control freak nonsense colonial narrative, including astrology and all forms of metaphysics, because, they formed a priesthood and everything. But really, at its beautiful, essential quality, each chart, say, of a person is our own inner democracy. There are no bad planets or good planets. We're throwing that thing out. It's an inner democracy to kind of wheel and deal and to honor all these parts of us, including the shadow, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Inwardly and outwardly, yeah?
Exactly. And so, the thing is, there are planets that are very challenging to deal with. And how challenging they are will differ from one person to another.
And culture.
I look at my own natal chart. Saturn's very well placed in it. Saturn is nicely placed in one of his rulerships. He's trying my natal sun. He's trying my natal Mercury. Saturn and I get along very well. Many people have huge Saturn problems. Okay,
well, it's about authority and outsource. We get into trouble when we outsource Saturn.
Exactly. The thing is, the horoscope, a natal horoscope, shows you, if you will, the outcome of the last election, the one that made you the president of yourself. And it shows you where who your supporters are, and which factions you're going to have to conciliate, and it just gives you an idea of the legislature of yourself that you're going to have to deal with for your term of office, which runs from birth to death.
Well, okay, now I want to break free of this metaphor now, or shapeshift it. But we're in our final all too soon minutes. But I would love to keep this going, John Michael Greer, because there's so many ways to go, and the role of entheogens, and and kinship, but the moon and Jupiter and Mercury are overhead. I mean, so do you have a spicy well-wishing you'd like to spiral out?
What I'd like to spiral out and to spiral in, I'd like everybody, find the Donald Trump in yourself and find the job that he's actually well-suited to do.
What is it? Help us. Don't leave us with that.
It depends on how your internal legislature is laid out. Find his job. Find him a proper job. It's not president. Find him the proper job for him to do and get him to work on it. Okay. Maybe you need some real estate developed in your psyche.
No, Lordy, I don't know. That this is awfully challenging. You're hurtling us into the abyss. But that's perfect. That's right. No solutions.
Hey, that's where we've been all along.
But now cultural hijinks. No, but exactly. I do have to say that Ceres Demeter conjunct Venus. Its image. Okay, this is us on our way out, kind of thing. Its image is men toiling in a dark pit. A woman calmly lowers a rope. And I like that because the woman's within all of us, going, oh you hoo, oh boys, industrial, whatever, collaborative. Yeah, right, with the earth, here's a rope. Here's a rope.
We don't have to stay stuck in the pit.
No, we can climb out and we can rejoin the choreography of creation by cahooting with all the plants and animals and deriving our leadership structure from nature. And there we go. That's the inner democracy. Anyway, fabulous to cahoot with you, John Michael Greer.
I had a great time.
His website is ecosophia.net. Let's keep this conversation rolling. Everybody assuming responsibility for dreaming the world into being inwardly and outwardly. That's really great. Thanks very much, John Michael Greer.
Thank you.
Pleasure. And thanks, Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. Always a delight, and it's good to see all the KPFA team here. How wonderful. I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com, brewing lots of citizen trickster trainings coming up. Woof, woof, woof. Oh, yeah,